My name is Brad Wilson, which means, yes, we're showing our slide deck. Always good. I used to work in pattern practices. I worked on Enterprise Library. I worked on Object Builder. I worked on CAB. So sorry for two out of three of those. Enterprise Library, by the one that turned out best. No, I'm kidding. Those were all great stuff. I moved on. I worked on CodePlex for a while. Now I work on the ASP.NET team. I've been on ASP.NET MVC for, well, it's basically two versions, right? Because we shipped two, and we're about to ship three, right? We're already in our beta phase for MVC 3. So the talk today is going to be some agile web development tips and tricks for ASP.NET MVC. So quick show of hands, how many of you develop web apps? Okay. I don't know what the rest of you people are going to do for the next 50 minutes. Sorry about that. How many of you develop web apps in MVC or are thinking about it? Okay, so that's actually probably most of the people. I'm an agile guy. If you've seen me at these conferences before, I tend to like to get up here and be a little preachy on the agile stuff. So I thought what I would do is a little brief introduction on TDD. So when we talk about test-driven development, we are talking about doing component testing, right? So when we talk about doing component testing, what that really means is I want to take a component that I'm developing and I want to test it in isolation. Isolation, in this case, means I want to test that component without testing anything else that it talks to. So there's value in testing the whole stack. That's not what TDD is about. I'm going to show both. But I find TDD is probably the one most people are least familiar with, so I thought I'd give this little five-minute introduction on it before we talk about how to do it with MVC. So when you're testing your components in isolation from one another, the process you usually use to isolate these components from each other is we call them test doubles, right? So if you've used a mocking framework or a stubbing framework or, you know, in the old days we used to call it like interface-based programming, you know, where you swap something in for something else, that's kind of what we're talking about when we do component and isolation testing. Just as important when you're doing TDD is you want to only test the things which are externally observable. So what that means is sort of in a negative sense is you don't want to be testing anything which is an internal implementation detail of the component. You want to push some data at the component, right? Maybe poke it, give it an event to do, give it some data, see how it interacts with the outside world. And in this case, the outside world is those test doubles that we're going to put in there. All right, so when you write TDD tests, these are sort of the three principles that I look for when I write a TDD test. I want them to be very small. Like, the test should be 5, 6, 7 lines of code. Beyond that, I'm not very happy. All right, I want them to be very simple. I want them to be very easy to set up, very easy to run, very easy to look at and understand what's going on. And, you know, when you do those first two very fast, just sort of comes along for the ride. So, TDD in a nutshell. That is the green state. Green state's where everything, all the tests are passing. So you start out, you create a project, it has no code in it, it has no tests in it, you are in the green state because all of your zero tests are passing, right? First activity you're going to do when you do test-driven development is you are going to write a failing test. Right, and the process of writing a failing test and then immediately running it will be a transition to the red state. We now have a failure. Now notice, I haven't talked about any production code, right? What I want to do first is write that failing test, and we're going to see why that's important here in a minute. And just as important, we want to run it and make sure that it goes red, because going red is important. Once you're red and you need to go to the next step is obviously we're going to write some production code that will make that failing test pass. This is your basic loop in test-driven development. When I'm sort of in the groove, this cycle takes me about 90 seconds. So when I'm talking about small tests, I'm talking about small tests, really small, absurdly small. If you've never seen anyone do TDD before, you're going to think I'm crazy. Very small. There's a couple other activities in TDD that are important. One is occasionally you will write a test that passes. Sometimes you'll write it on purpose because you're sort of documenting behavior that's already been implemented and already shown through another test. But sometimes you will write a test that you thought was going to fail, and it passes, this is why we like to run the tests right away and find out what's going on. And the last thing is refactoring. Whoops. So when I talk about test-driven development, I tend to like to say the T is wrong and the D is wrong, right? Because it's not about testing, it's about design, right? And so if you've, I don't know if anybody read my blog, I'll have my blog URL here at the end, but I have a blog post which is called, it's not TDD, it's design by example. And this process really is about writing code which describes how you want your components to behave. It's about saying, I'm going to become the first consumer of this client. I'm going to specify the behavior I want out of this client by writing a test and watching it fail. And then I'm going to write just exactly enough code to make that test pass. No more, no less. Right? And then iterating that. The interesting thing about this is if you write your production code before you write your tests, you will very often write more production code than you need, and sometimes not write the right production code either. You'll come through and you'll do unit testing afterwards, and you'll find, oh, I missed some things. But the more important thing is you won't realize maybe necessarily that you wrote code that you didn't need. By writing a test first, you get into a situation where the test is describing the behavior, and when you have enough code to make the test pass, and that's it, you know when to stop writing your code. Right? You know when you're done. You don't accidentally gold plate your class. The interesting thing is that the end result of this, unit tests, are actually an artifact, right? But they're not the goal. The goal is to design the code properly. And the artifact is used in two ways. One is refactoring, which we're going to talk about in like about 12 seconds. But the other is it's also to give you confidence that you can run these tests at any time and that the system is still behaving in roughly the manner you expect it to behave. Now, this isn't the only kind of testing, and I like to call this developer testing. And the reason I don't like T in test is because people think test is a quality assurance term. And in a way, you are getting quality from this process. But the point of this process is not necessarily quality first. Quality is an artifact, not a goal. Right? This is really a design process. So that's sort of an important aspect of T&D. So refactoring is one of these words that I think a lot of people have used that might not all necessarily mean the same thing we say refactoring. So for me, I like to say, you know, the baseline for refactoring, this is this first bullet point. Change the implementation without changing the externally observable behavior. All right, so if you remember 3.5 minutes ago when I said only test externally observable behavior and not internal implementation details, this is why. Because if you're testing the internal implementation details of your class, then when it comes time to refactor to make that code better, you're going to break tests. But if all your tests are written in such a way that they're only testing the externally observable behavior, then changing the internal implementation will not break those tests. So, built into Visual Studio for the last 5 years, unfortunately, and not longer, and not more. There's, you know, 7, 8 of these refactorings built in. There's also some third-party tools you can get that offer, you know, like 100 more. So ReSharper users, any ReSharper users? Any CodeRush/ReFactorPro users? Oh, wow, I'm the only one. All right. Awesome. I know what stock not to buy. All right, so the first demo is we're going to show some server-side unit testing. We're going to use a unit testing framework called XUnit.net. This also works with MS Test and other unit testing frameworks, but I want to show you a little bit about how this process goes. And to start off with, I'm going to take an empty Visual Studio, and we're going to hit the new project dialog, right? And pick your language of choice. My language of choice is C#. Sorry, VB programmers. I'm going to pick an MVC3 web application, and that name is fine. And what you're going to see, by the way, for people who haven't used MVC3 yet, this is our new project template dialog. So you can choose your template, which is empty or internet application. So you've probably seen, like when Chris Tavares was up here earlier, when Don Box was up here earlier, they were showing basically the default template for an MVC application. That's what internet application is. Empty is nothing. And We also have a new drop down here where you can select the View Engine, ASPX, and Razor. I'll just go ahead and select Razor because you guys are probably interested in that. And then this final box down here, unit testing project, you can ask it to create a unit testing project on your behalf. This drop-down is actually customizable. What ships in the box, if you're using Visual Studio Professional or later, is unit tests for the Visual Studio Unit Testing Framework. But you can also get plugins here for NUnit, MBUnit, XUnit.net, which is pretty much the other three choices right now for unit testing on .NET. So we'll go ahead, we'll pick XUnit.net, and we'll click OK. And if all goes well, which the first demo always crashes, so it's always interesting to see what happens here. Okay, we got two projects here that got created for us. We got MVC Application 1, MVC Application 1.tests. So you can see that, you know, one of the things we want to encourage you to do is we want to encourage you to do unit testing with MVC. And a lot of the things you see that we've put into MVC, and even as we go from version to version, a lot of this stuff is really to support agile practices like unit testing, especially TDD. So what's kind of cool about that is hopefully we can run all these tests and we will get success. Did that test fail? We start out in a green state, right? So he says the test should fail. So the interesting thing about this is when you unfold the default project template in MVC, right, you get some controllers by default, an account controller and a home controller. You get some routes in your global ASAX, right, things like that. So actually in the XUnit template as well as the MS test template, we actually provide some tests for you out of the box so that you can sort of see what these tests should maybe look like, right? So here's the test for the home controller, which is, you know, the home controller index should return this view and things like that. So we get you started. We get you a little bit ahead to sort of match up the code that's already in the project so you have some tests and get a good place to start. So you can see these tests are very small, right? So remember when I said small. If I go and I look at the implementation of home controller right now, you can see that the index method really literally does two things, right? He sets some data into the view model and then returns a view. And I have two tests that might even have three tests there. Nope, just two tests. So there's two tests there that basically test those two pieces of behavior, right? So very small tests, very easy to understand. New up the controller, call index, look at the view result, and tell me what the view name is. Right? Very easy to look at, very easy to understand. So when I'm writing a new controller, very often what I'll do is I'll say, you know, this controller needs to do three or four different things. I'm sort of thinking it over in my head, sort of doing that design in my head just as I'm writing those tests. You know, this controller is going to be feeding this view, and this view needs to have a list of products. Right, so I can imagine that what it's going to need to do is it's going to need to go off to some data repository and pull a list of products and then return a view with that list of products that I can show it. Right, so as I'm thinking about that in my head, those are the tests I'm writing to show that behavior. So I'll write those tests and then I'll write the controller code to match it. Okay, any questions? TDD? No? All right. So next thing I want to show is client-side unit testing. How many people write code in JavaScript on a regular basis? Okay, like seven of you. The rest of you can take a nap for 3 minutes. How many people love JavaScript? Okay, like four of you. That's actually more than normal. I love JavaScript. Don Box is right. You will all eventually be writing code in JavaScript because everything's going to be on the web, so... I'm going to show you a client-side unit testing framework. This framework is called QUnit. It is not something that we ship. It's part of the jQuery. It falls under the jQuery umbrella of projects. Right? It's written by John Russig, who does jQuery, and the guy whose name I would butcher if I tried to pronounce it, who does jQuery Validate. So this is kind of a cool. This is kind of a cool thing. So let's go take a look at, we can go ahead and close that Visual Studio. and go over to the one with all the code in it. So let's actually look at this demo. This fortunately, I'm going to need to sort of crank this up. You can see that what we've got here is we've got a web page, and it looks sort of like, you know, results from running tests. That's because it is. The little red bar across the top is to indicate that we have failing tests. And actually, in the case where the test is failing, it's actually showing us information about that test that failed. And these things are written in JavaScript using QUnit. And if you've done any unit testing in an XUnit-style framework, this stuff is actually going to look pretty familiar. All right, so I basically start out every test. I call the test method of QUnit, and I pass the name of the test, and then I pass the function, which is the test. And there's basically three assert methods. There's OK, there's equals, and the third one, which I never use. But you can see that if I make this 12 instead of 11, which is the result of that math, and then come over here and refresh this page, we now have a passing bar. Right, so now, with a framework that looks a lot like the server-side framework, right now I can take QUnit, and I can, when I'm writing my JavaScript for the client code, I can write unit tests against that JavaScript. I can even do it in TDD style if that's what I want to do. Unit test, period. Whether you do TDD or not, whether you believe in that or not, unit test, period. And having the JavaScript stuff here is very useful. The QUnit stuff, it turns out, is pretty kind of cool. So to get the driver running, you basically have, you just need to bring in jQuery and QUnit, and then I'm bringing in, of course, a reference to the math test, which is the test that I'm writing, and then a little HTML for it to display on the page. One of the things you can do that I don't actually have here, but you can have a specially named div with content in it that's normally not visible. So if the JavaScript that you're testing needs to go against data inside the browser, which is pretty common with JavaScript, you can put that data in there. You can find it with jQuery. So, you know, I'm going to go find element with this ID and pull it out and process it in my JavaScript and see what happens. Right? So QUnit's very much designed around the developer who's writing jQuery-based JavaScript. And I assume that most people here are familiar with jQuery who are doing JavaScript, because that seems to be a framework of choice for most people. So if you're not using jQuery, I think most of the frameworks end up having unit test frameworks that work pretty well with them. But if you're using jQuery, I highly recommend you look at QUnit. So, any questions about that? Yes?
How does this fit into TFS automated build?
Okay, so the question is, how does this fit into TFS automated build? An excellent question. Difficultly. The reason is, of course, in order to run this, you need a browser. And for most people, when you think automated build, you think a headless server in a server room somewhere that's running this stuff. So in order to be able to run it, you need a browser. So integrating it can be challenging if you don't have the kind of environment where you can, you know, leave somebody logged into that box that the browser can pop up and run all this stuff for you. That's kind of like the traditional challenge with JavaScript stuff. But it depends on the kind of JavaScript you're writing, right? If you're writing pure utility JavaScript that has nothing to do with the browser itself, you could use a unit testing framework that didn't require a browser. And that's easily automatable on a server because you don't need the browser automation. However, as soon as you start saying, I want to have this stuff run in a DOM, then it becomes more challenging. And because, you know, you actually want to have this stuff running in every browser that you think is important, right? You don't want to just run it in IE8. You want to run it in Firefox and Chrome and Opera and every browser that you intend to support. And if you're crazy enough, in every version of every browser that you intend to support. IE6, IE7, please tell me you're not supporting IE6. At least make it IE7. So, yeah, it's not the easiest thing in the world. But it's kind of par for the course for automation testing. You know, once we get past the simple logistics of plain old simple server-side unit testing, it becomes more challenging. So no magic bullet. Any other questions? No? Okay. Next demo looks like end-to-end testing. Okay, so The other kind of testing I want to talk about is automated acceptance testing, right? So we do TDD on the server side, and we make sure that our server components are working well in isolation from each other. We do our unit testing on the client side in JavaScript and make sure all of our all of our JavaScript client code is working well in isolation from itself. But now we want to test the application as a whole, right? And so end-to-end testing is the kind of testing where you want to automate that experience of running the application as a whole. So the framework I'm going to show you is a framework by the ASP.NET team, which is called the Lightweight Test Framework. It's actually the Lightweight Test Automation Framework, but it didn't quite have that much space. So we call it LTAF. It's actually done by the QA team on ASP.NET. So let's go over here. And let's take a quick look at this. So when you bring up the Lightweight Test Automation Framework window, you actually get a window that's split in half, right? And the left half is this ability to pick what tests am I going to run and see the results, right? And then the right half is you're actually going to watch while these things run. So let me go ahead and run all these tests, all these one tests. Right, and you can see that I'm automating my application over there. This test is to make sure that fields are required, and my test passed because I got a little green check mark. Right, and the cool thing is you can watch it while it automates. But now you're seeing my application run from end to end. Right, I'm running my application as a user would inside the browser, typing into fields and clicking things, interacting like a user would. Now, this test isn't particularly complicated because I wanted to keep a lot of these examples simple so we could get through a bunch of them because I've got like 8 or 9 of them. But these things can be fairly complicated, right? The idea that you could write a test that goes in and registers a user account, and then the user registration process sends somebody an email, and so we intercept the email process and look at the link and bring the link up and click it and click confirm and then log in and make sure to have access to stuff, right? A big, long, complicated step. So as opposed to unit testing, where I like tests to be very small, very understandable, very fast, end-to-end testing is very much about covering entire scenarios and making sure your functionality works across the entire scenario. Let's actually introduce a failure into this test down here. Last name is not required. All right, we'll recompile. Right, and then we run the tests, and you'll see we get the error indicating we had a problem. When I click on that, you get a little stack trace, which is going to tell me I expected last name is not required, but I actually got last name is required. And then down here, you can see the page that we captured when we ran that test. So, pretty cool. How many people are doing stuff like this? One. Okay. Please, please, your testers will love you setting up with something like this. Because in all honesty, if your testers are sitting there clicking the same thing, running a script over and over again, you're wasting your time. Right? That's exactly what a tool like this is for. So take advantage of a tool like this. There's Lightweight Test Automation Framework is free. It's on CodePlex. Not only the binaries, but the source is on CodePlex. If you have Visual Studio Ultimate, there's stuff in Visual Studio Ultimate, which is like this on super steroids, right? So sort of pick based on your needs, but definitely investigate into automated framework testing, end-to-end testing. Any questions on this? No. Okay, so the sugar coma hit, right? Nobody wants to ask questions. They don't want to sit in a chair. If anybody wants to come sit in a chair, they can just come sit in a chair, although it's going to be hard to see the screen. But, oh, there is a screen in front. That's awesome. A screen in front. Thank you. I've been using that screen the entire time. You'd think I would have remembered that. All right. So enough about testing, right? So those are sort of the three types of testing I like when people ask me, what kind of testing should I do with my MVC app, right? Server-side unit testing, client-side unit testing, end-to-end automation testing. You do that stuff. It's going to be great. Now I just want to show you some things that will make your life better when you write MVC applications, especially if you're doing testing, but they'll make your life better. The first thing is filters. So filters is a feature we've had in MVC since 1.0. And the idea, and you've probably used them, if you've written an MVC app, you've probably used filters before. The idea behind a filter is that it's an attribute that you can apply to your controller or to your action method. And it can run in different scenarios, depending on what interfaces you implement, right? It can run before and after an action is taking place, before and after a result is being executed. It can run whenever you have an error, right? So these things are very powerful. If you've done aspect-oriented programming, you can think of it as a poor man's aspect-oriented programming. You take these orthogonal concerns, like error handling, and you put them in these attributes that you can then apply all over your application and not have to have error handling code all throughout your application. Okay? So, the filter example. Let's go ahead and run this. Okay. That's interesting. So this demo is pretty simple. We go and look at my controller. You can see here the controller waited for 690 milliseconds, 988. When we go look in the controller, you can see I'm just waiting for a little bit of a random amount of time. All right. Waiting for a random amount of time, and then returning to view, telling me how long I waited. So the filter I'm going to apply is a filter I wrote called the request timing filter. And one way you could do this is you could say request timing filter right there on the action method. That means that filter will be applied to that action only. I could also put it up on the controller class itself, which means it'll be applied to every action in the controller. So let me recompile this. It's going to be very exciting. Okay, cool. Well, it told me that the controller waited for 258 milliseconds. My filter actually times how long everything took. And it took 258 milliseconds. And the rendering took 884. That's like a first time we hit the page, right? We have to compile the ASPX into code. So the second time should be a little bit better. Because once we've compiled it into code, right? So this filter was actually pretty easy to write. I'm overriding on action executing on action executed, on result executing on result executed. And basically, I'm getting a timer and I'm starting and stopping it. And then at the end, I'm just shoving an H4 into the end of the content. All right, nothing really exciting here, but it gives you an idea of the kinds of things you can do with a filter. All right, so I can intercept some of that stuff. The interesting thing is, you know, something else I can do with this is, what if I don't actually want that action to run? I could, for example, return, let's say, no, that's not what I want. So filter context dot do result is a new content result. Oops. All right. And then we recompile this. Whoops, what did I do? Did something wrong. New content result. Does not contain one constructor argument. You probably want the... Ah, yes. You want no constructor arguments. Okay. So you can see what I did there is I put my action in the middle. And I said, you know what? Whatever action you thought you were going to run, this is... we're done. Here's your result. Don't run another action. But the interesting thing is you can still see that we did the execution and rendering timing down here. But of course it was really fast because how long does it take to turn this to dump this string out to HTTP? So the other thing you can do with filters is you can intercept the pipeline and sort of redirect things around. This is often used, like one of the filters we ship in the box is the authorize filter, right? So an authorize filter gets involved in the authorization step and says, I don't think that person should be doing this, so you're not authorized. Right? And it basically ends up sending them off to the login page to say, you can't do this. Maybe you should try a user account that can. Right? So there's all kinds of things you can do with filters. And these nice orthogonal concerns means you can isolate this code. You can test it independently of all the actions you're going to put it on. And even better, when you unit test your action, you don't need to check that it does that stuff because you've already checked that when you unit tested the attribute. Right? For completeness, you might write a unit test that says this attribute is applied to this action or applied to this controller, but other than that, that's it. You just kind of assume that it's going to do its work. Right? So you've by splitting that stuff apart, you've made both sets of code easier to understand, you've made both sets of code easier to test. Any questions on this? No. Really? Sugar coma. Telling you. All right. What's next? Even I don't remember. Action results. So a lot of times when people in MVC are having difficulty testing their controller actions, one of the things people say is, I have to mock out too much to get my controller action to work. I have to mock out the request, and I have to mock out the response, and I have to mock all this stuff. And the answer I usually give them is, you should probably write an action result. So we have some built-in action results, right? View results to return a view. We just saw content result. There's redirect result. There's stuff like that. So the interesting thing is, by using a result, right, in my action, I don't say response.redirect to this URL. Instead, I say return redirect. And that returns a redirect result. Now, the benefit of that is I don't have to have mocked out any of the HTTP infrastructure. I didn't have to mock out response to say, by the way, I'm expecting someone to call redirect. My unit test is much simpler. My unit test says, you know, please look at the result that I got back from running this test. Was it a redirect result? And if it was, what were the action and controller that they wanted to redirect to? Right? And once again, you have this, you know, I put separation of concerns here. So the concern of how do I redirect belongs to the result. And now the action just needs to think about, yeah, this is what I want to do. I want to redirect. So I return the result. And again, the test becomes simpler. So let's take a look at an example of this. So this is probably easier to look at the code first. So I have some sample data here, and I have an example of an XML result, which we don't actually ship in the box. Right? This XML result is, I would like to return this thing as XML. So I've written it in two different ways. I've written it without using an action result, and I've written it with. And you're going to see that when I run this, the running part's not going to be all that exciting. Because, yay, it's XML. Right? You just saw an hour of that. And I run it with, yay, it's XML still. But the difference is, look at how much simpler that action method is by using that action result. It's one line of code now instead of five. But more importantly, the unit tests that would result from that. Right? If I look at without, you know, I have a hard dependency on XML serializer. I need to check the response content encoding got set correctly. I need to check the response.content type got set correctly. And I need to have an output stream for this thing to write to. Right? So if I look at what do my unit tests look like with this, they're kind of ugly. Right? That's the unit test for without. And that's pretty simple. And oh, by the way, my final assert is inspecting that XML. Which, ugh. That's not really what I want to do. Right? I would rather write that unit test, which is run this and make sure that what I got back was an XML result and that the things that were inside were what I expected. I got the right class in there, I got the right content type in there, and I didn't have to mock anything out. So just to show you again. All right, I'm using, by the way, if you guys have not seen, this is mock-u. It's mocking, and you can see I have to have a setup here, which is when they call controller context.http context.response.outputStream, by the way, give them this memory stream. And then when we're done, did they set, you know, response.content encoding and content type, and then turn that stream into an array and turn that array into a UTF-8 string that I can look at and then inspect the XML. So I don't know about you. I want to write the second unit test. I don't want to write that. I don't want to write this ever again. All right, so writing action results, your own custom action results, is a way of separating how do I mechanically do this thing I need to do away from any actions that might want to do that in the future. Any questions on this? Yes, way in the back.
How do you test the action result?
How do I test the action result, he says. That's a great question. Well, let's look at what's inside the action result. You already know the answer to this question, right? So the action result, by the way, looks pretty much exactly like, well, I guess I scrolled one too far. Looks pretty much exactly like the code that was in the action. Right, so when I write the unit test for the action result, well, I'm going to write 3 or 4 unit tests for the action result, probably, in total. But then I'm done with it. I'm never going to have to do that again. All right, so this is the important thing. Just like in the last one where I said, you know, I want to write this attribute once and then be done with it. And I want to use it everywhere. It's exactly the same scenario. I want to write this action result one time, test it one time, and be done with it, and then use it everywhere. Right? That makes sense? Any other questions? No. All right. Next.
I had a question.
Yes. Yes, the unit test in the actual action result class looks pretty much exactly like the unit test that I had down here, right? Where I have to mock out the HTTP context. So instead of newing up a controller and calling a method and expecting it to do this stuff, right, the action result will take an object that I have and serialize it to XML, serialize it. And actually, probably if I was going to write this, again, remembering isolate components from one another, I'd isolate the serialization from the action result. Because the action result's job is to take this object, take the serialized form of this object, set a few HTTP headers, and send it on its way. And I don't really need to test the XML serializer. I assume the .NET team did that. So that's how I would unit test. All right. Link helpers and named routes. So an interesting thing happened. We ship MVC in the box. MVC by default, we have one route, and it looks like controller/action/ID, which is interesting, except probably not the route you're going to use. Right? You're probably going to want routes that are a little more, well, they're called like hackable routes, right? Routes that the user can intuit information about and make little changes and successfully get the results they want. Right, so again, the last talk you saw Don talking about, you know, he didn't use the phrase, but the OData routes were hackable routes. They're things you can sort of intuit information about. Oh, this is how I get the information about product number one. I better know how to get the information about product number five. Right? So what happens when you write a real-world MVC app is you end up having, you know, a dozen, two dozen routes because you want these things to be very user-friendly and very hackable. And then you start to lose track of the best way to sort of get links to those routes. And if you need to change those routes around before you deploy, then you have this problem of, you know, I got to go change a bunch of places where I'm calling these things. And even getting a link to these things means you have to know what controller and what action name you're going to use to get these routes. So instead, what I like to do is I like to use these link helpers. Right? And they help me isolate routing and area changes. So the example here, named routes. All right, here we go, 3 people. Scott Densmore, you're going to be tired of him by the time you see him for a third time again tomorrow. All right, so Scott's and me. Right, and if we do a little zoom up here, you can see that my route up here is named routes people, right? And if I hover over edit, yeah, that's great. You can see down here that, it's really hard to see, so let me just click edit. All right, you can see that my route up here is people edit 3, right? So this is a pretty standard route. I actually left the default route in place, which is controller action ID. But what's interesting about this is, there's Scott Densmore's email address, in case you need that. What's interesting about this is, so in named routes, let's actually look in the view first. All right, so let's look in the index page, which is the list of stuff. Right, and you see these routes here? HTML, people edit link, AJAX, people delete link. Right, these are not built in. These are HTML and AJAX helper routes that I wrote, extension methods that I wrote. which is get me a link to edit that person. Right? And its title should be edit. Right? Compare that with this first line here that's commented out. HTML AJAX link. In fact, I have to zoom back out because I can't see the whole thing. HTML AJAX link, edit people, new ID equals person.id. Who likes that better? You see what I did there? I asked a question where no one had to raise their hand because you're all asleep. All right. So I like people edit link better. It's much easier to deal with. And writing extension methods is very simple. All right, so I have link extensions over here. So here's my people edit link. By the way, it's HTML action link, all that stuff you just saw that was over in the view that I had commented out. Except now it takes link text and person and automatically makes the correct link for me. All right, so now everywhere where I need a link to edit a person, and I happen to have that person in hand, why? Because I'm listing them out, because I'm sharing their details, whatever. All I have to do is pass that person along, and I'll get a link back. Right? So this will help you isolate changes from routing, from areas, from moving things around, changing controller names, changing action names. In my opinion, your URL should almost never have your controller or action name in them. Or if it is, then it's incidental because your action name or your controller name describes the thing the user thinks about. Right? Controllers and actions are implementation details for me as a developer. They're not things my users care about. My users care about hackable URLs. Right? Okay, questions? Yes?
What's the best way to hide your URL?
The best way to hide my URL? Hide it how? to make it not be hackable. Okay, the best way to make your URL not be hackable, if you hate your users, is to put GUIDs in them. Right? Who hasn't seen the early ASP.NET blog engines all had GUIDs in them? How crazy insane is that? Do you imagine me reading one of those to my mom over the phone? Yes, open curly. What's a curly? Yeah, okay. So, you can't hide URLs. The reality is that web spiders will find stuff even if you don't have links to it, because they're smart. Promise, they will find stuff you cannot believe. So hiding your URL is not a good form of security. So I always advise people to have URLs that make sense when I look at them. Make sense. I can look at that URL. What am I going to see? I'm going to see the details for person number 5. You know what? Even 5 isn't good. Even 5 is bad. It would have been better if it said person edit Brad Wilson. All right? That would have been even better. Because then I could know how I would get from my edit page to Scott's edit page, because I know Scott's name. I don't know Scott's user ID. Right? And now, because I've hidden this behind this link helper, I can change the details of that URL without having to go change anything else. Right? Any other questions? No. Okay. Next slide. Client and server-side validation. So in MVC2, we added validation as a sort of a first-class citizen. MVC 1.0, we had this iData error info stuff. Please don't use it. We're sorry. Use the validation stuff we put in MVC2. We've made it better in MVC3. You can write both server and client-side validation. Very easy to write server-side stuff in MVC2. A little challenging to write the client-side stuff in MVC2. We've made it easier. And in MVC3, we've introduced unobtrusive validation, which hopefully anybody who's done any MVC will appreciate. Okay, so you will have seen, this is a traditional form, right? Title and price. Both of these things are required. I'm going to zoom in and hit enter. Oh, yep, I can see it. So you know we can tell when it's posting back because the thing spins, right? So when I click and the thing doesn't spin, that's client-side, right? So we're seeing client-side validation there. So the first thing I want to show you is I want to show you the unobtrusive stuff in MVC3. Okay, look at this. That is the input tag for title. And it says data val equals true. Ooh, I'm validated. Data val required equals title is required. Ooh, that's the message for when I'm required. Right? So the validation is now inside of attributes on the input tags. If you've used MVC before, and you expect me to scroll down to the bottom and see this gigantic blob of JSON, you're going to be sorely disappointed because it's not there anymore. So all that stuff's on the input tags now. Yes?
Does Firefox respect those extra attributes? Are those actual attributes for an input tag?
Are they actual attributes for an input tag? No, they're not. Right. That's a good question.
What's Firefox going to do with that?
Firefox isn't going to do anything. So let me back up to the top of the page, and let me tell you what you're seeing here. This is an HTML5 doc type. Okay? HTML5 has introduced this concept. Well, for starters, you can put whatever attributes you want on elements in HTML. You can always go find them, right? But HTML5 has codified this to say data-whatever is reserved for people who want to annotate stuff with metadata. So all of our validation stuff starts with data-val or data-val-.
To say.
Yeah. Yes, VB's tag reigns again. I think that's what you said.
Rides
again. Okay, that's even better. So price is an interesting one. We haven't actually seen the other half of this. Price, in addition to being required, is also a number, right? And this required, we have a price validator, which says we have to put minimum stuff in here. So let's actually go and look at what that does. Put in a title, ABC. By the way, it's the other way you can tell client-side validation is happening. It happens while I type, for the most part. Okay, so I type A into a price. He's like, no, price has to be a number. Okay, that's good. One, price must end in 99, be at least 399. Fine, 199, not big enough. 1999. Oops. Oh, I guess my script's broken. I have to blame Phil Hack. He wrote that script. So there you go. Now I get everything succeeding. So the other half of this demo, not to show off unobtrusive stuff, because that was just kind of cool, but to show you the server-side implementation of this and the client-side implementation of this. All right, this is our price validation attribute. So the validation stuff that we do by default is based on data annotations, which is introduced in .NET 3.5 SP1 and enhanced in .NET 4. Right, and Tavares is here. He'll tell me the Antlib stuff now sort of semi-cooperates with data annotations, correct?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Our validator attributes are data annotation attributes, and our API can call it data
annotation. Awesome. So that means that when you use Antlib 5, which I think is when that was introduced, you can get built-in validation in MVC automatically. So the other interesting thing about this, obviously, this is our implementation, which is, did it end in 99? Is it the right price? But the other interesting thing about this is iClient Validatable, which is something we introduced in MVC 3, which says, please tell me about client validation for this attribute. And what that means is we need to return a rule. The validation type is price. The error message is whatever we said the error message was. And we have min, which is a min price. So now if I go back over here and I look at my source, you can see data val price with the message. Right, so price that we said, here's your type, that's what feeds in here. And then data val price min, 399, that's where that other piece of data came from. Right, so that stuff directly translates into unobtrusive attributes on the input. Now, the other thing we did to get this unobtrusive stuff to work is we wrote an unobtrusive JavaScript, blah, blah, blah. All right, so let's take a close-up of this. Right, so still shipping jQuery, still shipping jQuery validate, but we wrote two unobtrusive helpers for jQuery, one to do unobtrusive Ajax, one to do unobtrusive Java validation. Right, and what they do is they look for these data dash attributes and they wire everything up to jQuery automatically for you. Right, so the question of what does Firefox do with these attributes is nothing. It's that JavaScript which goes and finds those attributes and wires up and gets jQuery validate, primes the pump for jQuery validate, basically. Right? So the other half of what I had to do here was I had to write a JavaScript file, which is our price validator. Right, and you'll see that the validation logic here is pretty similar to what we had on the server side. Fortunately, we don't have an automatic translation yet, but maybe someday. So basically, the logic that's on the server side also exists on the client side. And then we wire it up to the unobtrusive stuff saying, by the way, this is going to show up as price with a value min to pull out of the attribute. Pretty much all that, so that's pretty much all that is required to get this stuff to work in client-side JavaScript. So I wrote my server-side logic, which I was going to do anyway, and I wrote a little bit of corresponding JavaScript and plumbed it into the MVC unobtrusive stuff, and away we went. We got client-side validation. Fairly simple, once you learn to love JavaScript, which you all will eventually. The JavaScript overlords are coming. All right, any questions about this?
Is this MVC 3 only, or is this supporting MVC 2?
Okay, question is this MVC 3 only? Some of what you're seeing is MVC 3 only. iClient validatable makes it much easier for us to find out about how to client validate something. That's MVC 3 only. The unobtrusive JavaScript stuff is MVC 3 only in the sense that it requires the MVC runtime to have changed to basically look at a flag which says, by the way, should I do unobtrusive JavaScript? And in fact, that's actually a flag we can change in webconfig. That's where we change it by default. So unobtrusive JavaScript, if I was to turn this into false, and then go back to this page, and then hit go again, refresh. We'll probably get a JavaScript error. We'll do view source. And you can see that this is now going to look like the old style, right? Just a plain old input tag with a big old blob of JSON at the end. Right, so you can sort of opt into which one you want in MVC 3. Any other questions? Nope. Okay, 2 minutes and 16 seconds. Awesome. Dependency injection. So dependency injection has always been sort of this thing that MVC has been semi-quasi-friendly with. MVC 3 is adding a lot in the way of dependency injection support. The big one is basically allowing you to register a container and saying, please go get a myriad of services that MVC uses out of the container. All right, so this is an example of it's injection. So here I'm using Unity from Enterprise Library, right? And I make a Unity container, and I register inside of it an implementation of iMathService, which is the math service class. And then I've done this. Well, this doesn't look entirely simple, but just because I didn't want to create another type. But if you have Common Service Locator, you can come and just register an instance of Common Service Locator, and we can use that. Now, the upshot of this is my controller. So the controller, the constructor in a controller takes an iMath service, and I don't have an empty constructor. So normally in MVC, when we have a controller, for example, of one place, now we're doing dependency injection, normally, if I had a controller, it would have to have an empty constructor because that's the only thing MVC knows how to create. But because Unity can look at this constructor, when we ask Unity to make the controller, can look at the constructor and say, aha, I know how to give you a math service, so I will. All right? Now, when I run this, what you're going to see is comb, dependency injection, model value 2 plus 4 is 6. Right, service add 2, 4, 6. Great, let's go look at the view. Interestingly enough, you can see the math service being used here by the view. 6 plus 8 is 14, right? And I'm also getting dependency injection through a new base class that I've introduced for view pages using the Unity dependency attribute. Right, so now the math service is also available to my view. Right, so we have dependency injection not only in controllers and view pages, but like probably a dozen other places where we pull services. So view engines, filter providers, model binders, value providers, all kinds of places. If you go to my blog and look, there's a list of all that stuff, including a bunch of blog posts on how to wire it all up. Right. So questions on this? You guys are all using Unity and dependency injection, right? Question?
This may be unrealistic, but sometimes I worry about the slight performance overhead of dependency injection on high-performance websites. Can you quell my fears? Is it negligible?
Do you use a database?
Yes.
Then don't worry about it. No, seriously. Everybody puts their database on another box and goes across a network and talks to a database. I swear to God, the 15 nanoseconds that Unity takes to create this thing instead of the 3 nanoseconds it would normally take, complete noise compared to your database access. Right? And the answer to websites that are too slow is not to turn off the things that make us more productive, but usually the answer is to cache. Right? So Chris's CQRS stuff is one way to think about caching. Right? We're also doing some more caching stuff in MVC, but you know, the answer usually to a slow website is cache. So I wouldn't worry about having a problem you don't know you have until you've measured it and actually verified that you actually have it. But, you know, if there's particular concerns with MVC, you could ask me. And what I'll do is I'll put up my last slide here. You know, any particular concerns with MVC, you can ask me. You can go to our forums. That's that second link is the forums. MVC forums is staffed by not only the ASP.NET team, but also lots of people in the community who know what they're doing. So always a good, you know, if you have performance concerns, please contact me. My blog, with the 11 or 12 part series on dependency injection, plus the unobtrusive AJAX stuff and all that stuff, is on my blog. That's my email address. That's my Twitter. So obviously, you know, I'm reachable. Any other questions? Yes.
On the error handling,
the action filters.
What if you want to incorporate JSON in that, like if you want to call off an AJAX call, does that work?
Is there a way to make the error handling stuff work with JSON? I'm not sure what your question is, but see me directly after this, and I'll make sure that I get an answer for you. Because it sounds complicated. Any other questions? Yes?
I do that.
Oh, you do that. Oh, well, he'll answer your question then. That's great. Thank you for volunteering. Any other questions? Awesome. Thank you very much for your time.